720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today and sharing part of your Saturday with us. Always very grateful to you for that, especially when, holy moly, it is gorgeous outside. How is this mid-February? I do not know, because it feels like a beautiful late spring afternoon in Chicago, and I think everybody is taking advantage of that. Everyone walking by the Michigan Avenue studio is looking really happy about all the sunshine, so I hope you get a chance to get out there and enjoy some of it for yourself. Nonetheless, lots to do today on the program. We are going to be talking with a reporter at LA Times here in just a little bit about factory jobs, moving from Ohio to Mexico and all around all the places, all the things. We're going to be talking about lots and lots of things. But to kick things off, I want to talk about a very, very interesting story connected to the International Auto Show. Please welcome back to the program Drew Harwell, a business reporter at Washington Post. Hi, Drew. Thanks for coming back on with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this story, the minute I saw it, I thought it was so, so fascinating. And it's one of those, it's kind of a cultural tell where just because something plays well in one market doesn't mean it's necessarily going to play well in another. And so the F-150 pickup truck that is all around all the places, everybody knows that truck, it has been introduced to the Chinese market. And it seems like buyers don't quite know what to make of it. Oh, Drew, did we lose you?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm back.
There
yeah,
you go. You're back. Okay.
Driving around, I guess.
Right. Okay. But nonetheless, so as automakers have put this F-150 in the Chinese market, suddenly buyers don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating contrast. And you see it's like a culture clash, because the F-150 is this like quintessential American truck.
Right.
You know, it's been around. It's like this, you know, farmhand special almost. It's been the best-selling car for so long. And yet now it goes into China, which has a very different culture, a very different driving attitude, and very different looking cities where, you know, it's not so easy to maneuver this tank of a vehicle through the streets of Beijing as it is through Dallas or even New York. So it's this interesting sort of bet from Ford that they can get that kind of excitement that you see and in parts of America where the F-150 is so huge. And they're thinking that maybe we can sort of share that bit of Americana and Chinese audiences and get a new audience.
So why now? I mean, the F-150 has been around for 35 years. So a while, right? It's been around so long, and it's been such a high seller for so many years. Why in the world introduce it to a Chinese market right now?
I think Ford's hand was almost sort of forced, and it's sort of an interesting function of, in China, there was a gray market, effectively, of these F-150s where Chinese buyers who had a lot of money and wanted to be able to drive something very American and big and bold, they would buy it through these unauthorized, sometimes illegal transportation networks. So they would be imported from Canada, or they would be driven sort of over the border. And Ford was making none of that money. And yet they were seeing how popular it was. And they were seeing how other trucks were being sort of brought in the same way, the big Dodge Rams and that sort of thing. So Ford started to say, well, why don't we start picking up some of this attention and excitement and money mostly. But the issue was that there are Ford factories in China that make cars Fords for the Chinese market, but they're all sort of smaller cars. They're economy, they're sedans and city cars effectively. So there were no factories that were able to build the, you know, big frame and chassis and engine and all the sort of things that go into the F-150. So it was kind of a logistical, I think, puzzle at first. And now they're starting to, well, we're just going to build them in America. We're going to ship them halfway around the world, and we're going to sell them for a lot of money. And so their hand was sort of forced in that way.
That is a really interesting approach to build them here and ship them around. And it seems also very interesting, and I see the allure of why perhaps Ford would want to do this, given how Volkswagen played there. Here, Volkswagen really took a beating in the U.S. market after all the emissions scandal and all of that, but yet didn't seem to be quite as scathed there in the Chinese market.
That's exactly right. Yeah. I mean, Volkswagen is the biggest automaker in the world. And a large part of that is from the Chinese audience. You see in America how their sales have plummeted. And In the auto industry, it's a really sort of fascinating symbol of trade and how our products and our lives come from all around the world, not just one country or one city anymore. It's this sort of global network of how things move around. So, you know, with Ford, they saw a market halfway around the world. They realized that they only really had the capabilities here to make them. And so they started selling them there. In the same way that we're talking, and President Trump is sort of leading the conversation in his very Trumpy way of talking about where our products come from, how much we value stuff being made in America. Those are all important things, but what goes into these cars and trucks is such an elaborate system. No, it's very rare for one vehicle to be made in one factory. There are, you know, dozens, maybe hundreds of components that go into every car, just like there are that go into every computer, you know, the machines that sort of run our lives. So, you know, when we think about the car industry, it's really a global sort of franchise. It's no longer, you know, the Henry Ford sort of conveyor belt system of being in one country. And automakers see that. Places like Volkswagen and Ford, they recognize that there's no way to just stay in one country and survive anymore when everybody else is selling not just to American drivers, but Chinese audiences, audiences across Europe, audiences across South America. So it's a really fascinating look at this global sort of market that we all live in now.
Definitely. And do we see the F-150 competitor trying to move into that market, too? I'm thinking like the Chevy Silverado and those other just kind of very iconic big American trucks. Do you get the sense that there's a plan from those automakers to move in as well?
Yes, they definitely are. Every automaker in that industry, in that part of the industry of these big honking full-size trucks is looking to go into China. And China, you know, is a fascinating place if you're trying to sell a big product that costs a lot of money because, you know, they're getting wealthier than they've ever been before. They have a really exploding middle class that has more money, more disposable income than they've had before. And, you know, while there are still an incredible amount of sort of products made in China by companies there that, you know, are tied to the government, are very much Chinese products, there's still an interest in, you know, the American way of doing things, the sort of Western style of especially driving. And you look at, you know, the F-150, it's to some audiences halfway around the world, it is the American product. It's the hamburger or the cowboy. You know, it symbolizes something. You know, this really adventurous spirit, this kind of bold feeling of owning the road, even when you're in a place like China where that may not even make sense. So, you know, all the automakers sort of want to be that seller and cater to that interest. And so I think we're going to be seeing that for a while now.
It's really interesting. And then when we start moving into thinking about trade and taxes and tariffs and all of that, it gets even more interesting because this is probably around a $50,000 vehicle in the United States. It's going to look more like a $70,000-ish, perhaps even more, vehicle there.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. I mean, as we've seen over the last couple of decades, China is incredibly protectionist. They really encourage products that are made in their own country, largely because it benefits the Chinese state there. And they impose really, really steep taxes and tariffs on products coming from other countries. And they also impose, you know, even more than the money side of it. They also like to have a really strong sort of creative control over a lot of these things. So it's fairly new that American products are even breaking into the Chinese market. So, you know, this is very new, and it's also very costly. And these automakers are having to sort of weigh the balance of, if we're selling a truck over there for what would be $100,000 here, is there going to be enough interest over there? Are there going to be enough people who both have disposable income to spend on effectively four wheels in a box? And are they also interested in the kind of cultural touchstone that we're selling and this sort of American bit of automotive? So, you know, that's big to them. And, you know, clearly they have crunched the numbers and said, even with these taxes and this really steep these headwinds that we're facing of the government, we're still going to try it. And, you know, when we talk about taxes and tariffs, that's increasingly becoming something we're thinking about in America, too. There's an incredible amount of free trade that American industry has depended on for a long time. Now, with Mr. Trump in office, there's questions of how much are we going to tax products that are coming in from overseas, and that's a big deal. That's something that can affect what it costs for us as consumers when we buy things from overseas, which happens all the time. And so it's sort of that idea, that question of what is worth it, what do we want to tax, and how do we want to encourage, you know, American business? Those are questions that are not just playing out at the automaker level, but at the consumer level now as well.
Yeah, truly. I was going to say, if we look at the other side of this, where Japanese automakers that are importing into the U.S., we immediately Toyota comes to mind, their officials have urged U.S. dealers to really be in touch with U.S. lawmakers and talking about like an import tax and say, hey, look, that could really impact American jobs, even though it's a Japanese company. And so, as you pointed out, very few components are purely, you know, in one country, even if it's assembled in one country, components come from all over the place and whatnot. So it is a really, complex and interesting piece. But everybody, head to WashingtonPost.com and check out this story by Drew Harwell. Thank you so much for being with us today, Drew.
Thanks for having me. Fun to talk.
For sure. Come back again anytime. All right, we're going to take a little break, and we come back, plenty more to discuss here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Again, I cannot stop looking outside because it is so record-breakingly gorgeous outside. It is sunny, and I hope that you are outside enjoying some of that lovely springtime in mid-February air here in Chicago. It is lovely. And you know, my joke all winter, Griffin, was every time we had like a nice day in the fall or winter, I would say, go outside and enjoy it. Your February selves will thank you. I think your February selves are kind
That's
of like
right, yeah.
in your face.
You did always say that.
Right? In your face, says our February selves. We're enjoying it just fine, thanks. So, you know, Griffin, we talk a lot here on this show about accuracy, and, you know, we always like get our backs up a little when people are maligning the media, whoever they may be. But it is really unfortunate when someone intentionally tries to spread misinformation. And 20th Century Fox has apologized for creating fake news sites and stories to promote a new film. It's a psychological thriller called A Cure for Wellness. This was like an elaborate PR stunt gone wrong, essentially, but they have issued a statement, and a spokesperson said that in raising awareness for our films, we do our best to push the boundaries of traditional marketing in order to creatively express our messages to consumers. In this case, we got it wrong. I mean, good for you for admitting that you were wrong, because that's not something all people are willing to do. But earlier this week, BuzzFeed broke the news that 20th Century Fox had partnered with this network of fake news sites specifically to publish made-up stories about everything from like Lady Gaga's Super Bowl performance to a fake meeting between Trump and Putin at a Swiss health spa, and like crazy. But some of them seemed to kind of directly reference this film, while others were just sort of unclearly, why are you doing that?
That's what I don't understand is the other stories. Like,
yeah, why do that?
Lady Gaga and Trump stuff, it makes no sense to me. But then filtered in, I guess that was just to like create the site, and then filtered into these stories were stories about this movie, A Cure for Wellness, that would be like screenings for upcoming psychological thriller result in panic attacks, or one man at a Utah theater had left in a catatonic state or something like that. So,
because then people go, ooh, I can hang.
So messed
I'm
up.
See it.
A Cure for Wellness.
What was that crazy movie years ago that everybody said things like that? Was it Faces of Death?
I don't know. That doesn't ring a bell. Maybe.
It was, which is essentially like clips of people's actual deaths caught on video.
Oh.
And there were the same kind of like, oh, people had a heart attack in the theater.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
So then people would go, oh, I got to see it. I got to prove that I can handle it.
Well, and that's the funny thing with this campaign. It rings like other campaigns for horror movies where they show people in the theater freaking out.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's sort of where this is rooted, but it goes so far as, but that's just footage of people screaming. I mean, this is like an actual headline about
someone having a panic attack.
Yeah, or like, yeah, being psychologically ruined by this movie or something. And it's so insane. But they thought, they had a really funny, you read their response, which was their apology, but that came later. Their initial response was not an apology. It was sort of an explanation of what they were doing. And they said, A Cure for Wellness is a movie about a fake cure that makes people sicker. As part of this campaign, a fake wellness site was created, and we partnered with fake news creators to publish fake news. Like, it's all part of this.
So someone...
It just makes me feel gross to even read it.
Right. Some marketer making a lot more money than we are was sitting in a conference room and was like, guys, I have it.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got this.
Like, do you feel like they were just a little too bored at work? And it's like, you don't have to try that. You went a little too far.
Maybe it was that, or maybe it was just like I don't have any better ideas. Let's just go with that one. I don't know. Maybe there was like a deadline, right? And the boss was like, look, if you guys can't come up with a marketing campaign for this movie, we're just going to go with this one idea. Anything else? Nope. Fine. We're going with that. But nonetheless, someone I'm sure making a very handsome paycheck did this.
Yeah.
This came from one brain.
And part of me almost thinks, like, what's the big deal? But you can't lie.
Right now, I think the stakes are too high.
Especially now. Yeah. I mean, fake news is such a hot button phrase.
You can't lie. And right now, I think the stakes are much too high to be screwing around with fake news. And especially if you're going to involve world leaders in said fake news. Because I think we all can agree, and it's pretty well documented, people are not reading the whole story. People look at headlines. People make an assumption. I mean, I've even gotten...
They were sort of banking on that. They were like, I hope that's what people do.
I hope people don't fact check this. Right. I've even gotten to the habit lately of when I share a piece on Facebook, I will even say, hey, read this. Don't internet read it. Meaning don't click through, look at the headline, the readout, and the first couple of sentences, and then go away. Actually read the thing. Because so often you'll share something on Twitter or Facebook or whatever, and someone will comment right away based on just the headline. And you're like, did you read it? Because in the third paragraph, it says exactly what your complaint is. You have already answered your own question and shown me that you did not read it. So there's that. But nonetheless, 20th Century Fox sure stepped in it with this marketing stunt gone horribly wrong with their fake news. So, and the fact that there is a network of fake news sites that they partnered with in the first place, that's concerning. So again, check your sources, people. Check the sources. Say, where is this coming from? Who wrote it? Is there a byline? Are the facts in it true? Can I source them? All of those things. We're going to devote a whole show to this sooner or later, Griffin. But nonetheless, right now, we're going to take a little break and get you to news. And when we come back, we are going to kind of continue a little bit of what we started earlier. We were talking about the automotive industry. We're going to talk a little bit about some manufacturing jobs and a shift and comparing two different cities with manufacturing jobs. When we come back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Still lots to do on the program, lots of things to discuss, but I keep looking outside. As you just heard in Bob Kessler's news report from upstairs, we have broken a record. It is so warm and beautiful outside. I hope that you're out enjoying it at the very least. But you know, WGN Radio is portable. You can do it on your smartphone app. So get yourself outside and enjoy some sunshine. Indeed. All right. Still lots to do on the program today. We're joined now by Kate Linthicum. She is a reporter at LA Times who has written a really, really fascinating piece that you can find at latimes.com. And it is comparing two cities that held a factory. First, this factory was in Warren, Ohio, and then it moved to Juarez, Mexico. And she takes a look at the jobs around this move and the factory and what that means, kind of taking a look at these two cities as kind of a microcosm. Kate, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So why did you choose to highlight these two cities in particular? Were they representative of a larger statement of factory jobs, or was there something else that brought you to them?
Well, so the North American Free Trade Agreement was such a big topic during this presidential campaign. Donald Trump, you know, portrayed this as a total mistake for the United States and really framed it as the U.S. as being sort of the loser in this agreement and places like Mexico as being the winner. And I kind of wanted to interrogate that a little more. I live in Mexico, and it seemed a little bit more complicated than that. So I decided to try to find a factory that had moved to Mexico, you know, more than 10 years ago to kind of understand over time what does globalization really look like and what does it look like when factories leave the U.S.
And what did you find when you started down that path?
So, I mean, I found some things that were, I think, predictable. I mean, the person that I met in Warren, Ohio, a guy named Chris Wade, who had worked at this Delphi Automotive auto parts factory for about 20 years, you know, after he took the buyout, he went through a total rough patch, you know, had a really hard time finding other work in these Rust Belt cities that have lost factories. There just isn't a lot of work outside of the service industry. So that was kind of what I expected to find. Going down to Mexico and seeing the effects of NAFTA there, I guess I expected the middle class to be bigger. I expected what Trump said, that there Mexico is the winner in this equation. And while the woman that I profiled there, Bertha Lopez, did indeed get work, and it was easier work certainly than the kind of work she had in the cotton fields growing up, it isn't, she's not really a winner by any means. I mean, she makes about $1 an hour compared to Wade's $30 an hour, and her life is really hard. She really has no ceiling for advancement. These are not great jobs by any means that we've sent to Mexico.
And, you know, when we talk about NAFTA, when we talk about the free trade agreement, I think, and of course, that's the casualty of any campaign, right? That things are going to get simplified into sound bites and into very persuasive ones on both sides nonetheless. But it really, I think the biggest takeaway from the piece that you wrote at LATimes.com is how it is so much more complicated, not just on paper and in the legal sense, but in the human sense. There's so many complicated nuances there that we don't really talk about. And that's why I thought this piece was so interesting, because you're taking a look at that human piece. But what other, when you think about the narratives around NAFTA, what other, you know, generalizations do you run into again and again, or maybe not misinformation, but perhaps popular misunderstandings?
Well, I mean, I guess I think that the maybe most important point, and the one that does sometimes get overlooked, is there have been clear winners with NAFTA and with free trade agreements, and those aren't workers in either countries. Those are the CEOs of the companies that are making these moves and are increasing their profits by extraordinary sums. The amazing thing for me with this story is, you know, in 2006, this company Delphi moved like 24,000 jobs, I think, down to Mexico. And they were in bankruptcy at the time, actually. This was as they were emerging from bankruptcy. And shortly after that, the CEO of the company was given a compensation package that some people have estimated was as much as $36 million. Mm. So I think that's something to keep in mind, that there are some people who are profiting, you know, quite a bit from this stuff.
Right. And so, you know, we have the Trump administration, who has just made a very large show of promising to bring back American factory jobs. You know, immediately, I wonder if it is even possible, advisable. Is it possible to turn back the clock? And also, I wonder, I think there's a more nuanced piece to this, and this is perhaps a very unpopular opinion, but it seems that in many cases, we ignore the role of technology in that, that it used to be the case that you would acquire a skill set and then go employ those skills in a factory setting. But as technology is advancing faster and faster, those jobs will have to be constantly adapting to that technology. And is that a piece that you ran into and that you felt like was on the radar and being compensated for?
I think that's a really good point. And I certainly have spoken to economists who say, you know, the biggest, the thing that did the most damage to the Rust Belt and other parts of America that have lost factory jobs wasn't NAFTA, it wasn't competition from Mexico, it was changing technologies. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're literally inventing ourselves out of jobs. And I think that's something that the U.S. and the rest of the world is going to have to grapple with in the coming years, is if we keep making things more efficient and more robotic and smarter and faster, like, you know, driverless cars. And I mean, where does that leave us? What are people going to do? So that was definitely something I thought about. And one other thing is competition from China. I think it's interesting that President Trump has chosen Mexico as sort of his main boogeyman in a lot of ways, when most economists will tell you that it's really been competition from China as much as or more than Mexico that has kind of contributed to this race to the bottom, if you want to call it, in terms of wages in factory jobs in the U.S.
Right, right. And then what about the cities themselves? As you profiled people to really put, a human piece of these two cities together, what about the cities themselves? What impact, you know, we often look at what happens when a factory leaves a U.S. city, but what happens when a U.S. company has its factory suddenly in an international city?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the answer to that question really varies. Like, there are cities in Mexico that have gained, like, you know, Ford plants and automotive plants that have really, it really has created like a strong middle class, and it really has created bigger, healthier cities. Juarez, Mexico is not one of those. It's not known as a healthy city, right? It was the murder capital of the world for a long time. And what happened there was, you know, one of the things NAFTA did is it really hurt the agriculture industry in Mexico. Because Mexican farmers just couldn't compete with farmers from the U.S. who were backed by U.S. subsidies. So you had this sort of emptying out of rural areas and this total urbanization with people going to cities like Juarez, and the city just wasn't prepared for it. Suddenly it had, you know, literally hundreds of factories and tens of thousands of workers streaming in, and it's this gray, brown city with dirt roads that just hasn't kept up, thanks in part to corruption. And what that did was, you had at the same time as these sort of drug cartels rising, and that meant a lot of easy recruits, and it became, yeah, one of the most violent cities in the world. So that's sort of been a downside.
Certainly. And then we add in, a proposed 20% tax on imports from Mexico. And we have the Mexican president really fretting that Mexico's cooperation with the U.S. on other matters are really going to have, are they're putting everything up for negotiation. So it's a really interesting time to be looking at these issues and looking at how it all really spins together in such an interesting and sometimes horrifying way, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mexico is definitely doesn't have the upper hand in this kind of negotiation, because 80% of Mexico's exports go to the U.S. So they're really deeply, deeply tied to our market. But Mexico does have a few things they can put on the table, a few bargaining chips. And if Trump really does try to impose this 20% tax on all imports from Mexico, if he really does start sending home, you know, millions of immigrants living in the U.S. illegally, Mexico can fight back by saying, well, we're not going to cooperate with you anymore on, security matters, or we're not going to stop enforcing immigration along our southern border, which has been a great gift to the United States in recent years. Definitely an interesting time for sure. It's been interesting watching the peso kind of plummet or rise based on every sentence Donald Trump says about Mexico. So yeah, we're all tuned in.
Yeah, I was going to say the administration is moving things along so quickly in stories all related to this that I'm sure we'll talk again in a week because this will perhaps be very, very different. But nonetheless, Kate Linthicum, thank you so much for being with us. Everybody head to LATimes.com and you can read this whole story about what happened when factory jobs moved from Warren, Ohio to Juarez, Mexico. Thanks so much, Kate.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break and we come back. More things to discuss on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. But you know what? Fret not. I'm not going anyplace. I'm sticking around. I'm going to be with you till 3 o'clock today, staring out the window here in the beautiful Allstate Showcase, looking out over Michigan Avenue at all of the beautiful sunshine. I cannot believe it is mid-February. I cannot even believe that it is mid-February because it's so darn beautiful outside. It looks like April or May or something. Nonetheless, Griffin, yeah. I can't make myself sit down and watch the Westminster Dog Show. I know that was just a very big thing that was happening. I can watch Puppy Bowl.
Okay.
I mean, on the Super Bowl commercials, I'll go flip over to Puppy Bowl or I'll put it on a screen and watch both, you know, because it's really cute to watch puppies frolicking. But nonetheless,
you don't like the control of the
that's what it is.
You prefer to watch them romping.
I know. I just want to see them like playing around. And I love the little the camera at the bottom of the water bowl when you just see them like slopping water everywhere. They're so cute and funny. But right, they're very they're much more dignified at the Westminster
Absolutely,
Dog Show.
Absolutely, yeah.
There was a really fascinating story in the New York Times about kind of the time and money and effort it takes to get your dog into that dog show. It is unbelievable. I recommend go find this story. The headline on it is "A Good Westminster Dog Show. It'll cost a lot more than some kibble." And it's talking about not only is getting a, you know, the dog has to be a pure breed. You can't just like haul in some kind of, you know, hey, I found this dog wandering, I don't know what he is, kind of creature.
I would like to see that.
I would love that.
But they don't do that.
They don't do that. You got to have like, you have to know the pedigree of that dog.
Yeah.
So that's going to run you a lot, right? If you're going to get some of those pedigrees, it's going to be like $5,000 dogs.
Yeah, they put it from like $1,000 to $5,000 here, I think, something like that.
Adopt, don't shop, man. But sure, okay, sure, yeah, whatever. That's a lot. That is a lot. But if this is your thing, and then I know some people are like have like a breeding thing, you know, they'll do like the stud fee kind of thing. So perhaps you'll make back some of that. But still, Lord, that's a lot. But then like this story goes on and it gets into like the grooming and the training and what's involved. And sure, there's like the $10 drop in class at Petco just so your dog won't eat your shoes. But we're talking about like really elaborate things these dogs need to be able to do.
Oh, yeah.
With very expensive training. Like we're talking about like sending your child to etiquette lessons kind of a thing, to finishing school for dogs, which is very, very expensive. What I enjoy, I thought it was so fascinating to read about the grooming stuff, like this 45-minute bath and then the hair dryer and all. Like every pet I've ever had, you even get the hair dryer out and the dog is going to haul to the other end of the house. They're like, I don't want that hair dryer on me.
I was thinking, I read that part about you have to dry the dog, of course, because you wouldn't just...
You can't let it air dry.
You can't leave your... They say it would be like just leaving your laundry in the washing machine.
It's like, dogs are not laundry.
You got to dry the dog.
You got to dry the dog. And I mean, I've seen some behind the scenes stuff where they have like rollers, Velcro rollers in the dog's hair. So yeah. It's like hangs. Poor dogs. I can't imagine it's that fun for dogs. But there was this funny beagle. Did you see him who just kind of let loose?
Yeah. Wait, at the like, what was that? At the, But tell me, what was it?
Well, it was at the part where they have to kind of like trot between little, little not cones, but like little markers.
An obstacle course. Yes.
He was doing that and he just kind of lets loose and goes full dog. And he's like, I have no patience for this nonsense and this human stuffy stuff. I am just, I mean, this is a dog debutante ball.
He would do one of the obstacles, like run up a thing and then back down and then sort of just veer off. Like,
he was just playing. He was just being a beagle.
There's other things to do. We've got other obstacles too.
He was like, look at all the things. I'm going to do all the things. Let's go.
Oh, so great.
It was super cute.
Very cute. Maybe less cute if you put like $30,000 into that dog.
That's where I'm going with that. If you've just spent, you know, $30,000 to be there at the Westminster Dog Show.
And that's one of the more conservative numbers this piece too. Like, somebody said she spent between $27,000 and $30,000. But then one person, and I just can't imagine, but said like, oh, hundreds of thousands. Because you're also paying the handler, because the handler is not the owner.
Right.
The handler is a person that is paid to handle this dog in the show. So then you're paying them to fly all over the country. So like over the course of a campaign.
First of all, ain't nobody flying anywhere with my dog. No way in the world.
Well, I think they go too. I mean, that's just all adds up. It's so wild. But and then I was thinking, okay, so this is a risk that you take as one of these owners.
Sure.
Much like maybe the owner of a horse in the Kentucky.
I was just going to say, it sounds Kentucky a lot Derby, like a horse
sure.
owner.
So this is a gamble. You put all this money in hoping to win it back in the competition. But you don't win any money at the Westminster Dog Show.
You win glory. You win bragging rights.
I know that I probably sound like very, I don't know, materialistic about this. And yeah, a true believer would be like, you can't put a price on the Westminster. But I mean, I'm imagining sort of playing out this conversation. But
right. I'm imagining this
playing out.
So all that
money is just gone.
Yeah. I'm imagining this playing out at like a dinner party or something where someone's like, oh, well, my darling poodle. Or this year it was a German Shepherd, I think,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah. Rumor.
Rumor. Named for the Adele song, they said.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
So you're sitting there with Rumor's people and you're like, oh, wow, you won the Westminster. What's I mean, because it's not like a Grammy. It doesn't. I don't know that it. What do you do after that? There's not like a Super Bowl of Westminster winners.
No, I mean, Westminster is definitely
the Super Bowl.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just feel like it is all about the glory. If you're a part of that world, it's very meaningful. Actually, when I was producing John Williams' show, we did The Bright Side of Life.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody called in and said her dog won the Terrier Group at the Westminster. And I was truly blown away. I was like, oh my gosh, I feel like I'm talking to a celebrity
right.
now.
That must be one hell of a terrier.
Her call dropped, so we didn't get her
on
the air.
Oh, man.
Big shout out to you. Congratulations.
On the terrier thing. Yeah. I want to talk to someone who's been there. I think that would be fascinating to like shadow them or just I want to understand about the dog show because it doesn't seem like it's fun for dogs. It doesn't seem like it's mean.
Also you're a cat person, right?
I'm a creature person.
Okay,
I mean that cat found me when Chairman Meow arrived in my life. I had not had a cat before. I had only had dogs.
Okay, I see. So you were not a cat person, you are that one cat person.
Right. Yeah. I'm a Chairman Meow Guth person of blessed memory. Rest his soul. Yes. So he found me. And you know what? At first, I think I treated him like a dog. I was like, are we fetching? What are we doing? I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do here. But nonetheless, there's definitely not a Westminster Dog Show of cats. Tell me, please. That's not a real thing because that would be literal cat herding. And we all know how well that kind of thing goes. That's not a thing. All right. Well, that wraps it up for us on the Wintrust Business Show. But fret not. I'm not going anyplace. I'm going to just take a break here and then go to news. But then come right back and I'll be on with you till 3:00. So back in just a bit on 720 WGN.